All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And without further ado, a guy that I've been dying to get on the show for quite some time. He's been kind enough to join us today, coming from the beaches of Hawaii, to discuss what's happening. Mr. Fleckenstein, Bill Fleckenstein of Fleckenstein Capital. First of all, Bill, thank you so much for joining us, especially since you're on vacation, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, and since you're in Seattle, it would have been hard for me to say no. That's where I'm from, right?
Right. Well, and that's exactly why I kept mentioning that on Twitter, because I was hoping that worked, and obviously it pulled the right heartstrings.
It did.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, all's well that ends well. I want to start off just trying to let, I've followed your work for a really long time. And I've got to say thank you, because I started my career off at Russell Investments and then came into the brokerage financial advisor world. The day I started was September 15th, 2008. Walked into the office the first day and reading your stuff. Now, I was all bared up at that time. I'd been reading a lot of your work and some other guys' work, and you guys helped keep me sane through that. And then also some sanity you've provided over the last 6-7 years. And then also I want to bring this up too. You had a little book come out in January 13th, 2008, I believe was the day. Greenspan's Bubbles. Did you time that way on purpose? I just think it's fascinating that book dropped then. You must have started it in 2006.
No, actually, there's an interesting backstory. Why don't I give you the backstory to the book with a little background on how it came about, because it might be a useful vantage point for your readers to understand my perspective. And
love
that
it.
Might be... we're trying to be helpful to folks, that might be the best way to do it, if you don't mind.
Oh, are you kidding me? Absolutely.
Okay. So what happened was, as you may know, I was a very vocal critic of Greenspan's policies in the late 90s. I thought that they would lead to a bubble, which they did, and it burst. And then I naively thought that after the first bubble burst, the Fed would learn its lessons from its misguided, too easy policies and rationalizations, and then they would recognize the error of their ways, and then that bubble would we'd clean up the mess and settle up some issues, and we'd move forward. That was I was right about the bubble, although I thought it would burst sooner than it did. But it's hard to guess when the madness of crowds is going to shift. But
yeah.
Then in 2001, when the economic damage started to show up from the bubble, because of the terrorist attacks, people blamed the weakness on that, and the Fed got a bit of a pass. So they cut rates, and then they precipitated the real estate bubble. And I had kind of given up going on CNBC and TV because I didn't really like CNBC and its overall message. But I went on some other stations, and I was writing a column for MSN in addition to my daily column, in addition to running my short hedge fund. And I was critical of Greenspan and the housing bubble. So it just so happened that there was a director at McGraw-Hill who didn't like what Greenspan was doing, for the interesting reason that McGraw-Hill owned S&P, which was one of the rating agencies which helped allow the insanity to go on. In any case, this particular director felt like Greenspan was the problem, and he wanted that story told. And so McGraw-Hill came and found me. They wanted a book to come out approximately when Greenspan's self-congratulatory, breaking his arm, patting himself on the back book, The Age of Turbulence, was going to hit. So they came to me, but get this, it was in the fall of 07. I literally wrote the book, and we got it published in under 3.5 months.
Whoa.
Because I had been writing a lot of this stuff anyway, and it just so happened that another a friend of mine had been trying to write a book about Greenspan but couldn't get it published, and McGraw-Hill talked to him, but they weren't as interested in his view as mine. And so the backstory was, I said, look, I can't write this book in enough time without, and check the facts all at the same time. So Fred Sheehan, who was my co-conspirator on this book, he was my fact checker because he'd already done a lot of this stuff. And I could just write and have him check the facts, and then we bang the thing out. And the deal was we split the proceeds, and they had to agree to publish his book, which was much more in-depth, a fair bit drier, certainly factual. And so I tried to write a version of what was wrong in a manner that everyone could understand. The first half of the book was comparing the FOMC minutes to what they were saying in real time and what was going on. And the second half was about the housing bubble and how it was going to lead to disaster. So the timing of it was not of my choosing. It was theirs. My description of events, though, of course, turned out to be somewhat, you know, pretty timely given that moment in time. So then, of course, after the 08 debacle, which was even bigger than the first bubble because it infected credit in addition to real estate and impacted everyone that had a house and chose to be a little, you know, aggressive with their financing. But after that bubble burst, so the Fed didn't learn a lesson from bubble one or bubble two. After that bubble burst, they started with QE. And when they started up QE, I knew it would lead to inflated markets. And so I closed my short hedge fund down and in the first quarter of 09. And then QE, then we had all the QEs and all that. And along the way, my point of view was, it's not possible to tell when QE is liable to the ending of when QE ends, QT begins, when that's going to impact the markets, because there are no data points. It's never happened before. And it could have been that the mere ending of QE, quantitative easing, would have broken the market, because the market tanked after the first two rounds of QE. It was only the QE3 and the other central banks getting involved that the markets went to the moon. And then it turned out they had so much momentum and so much, bullish psychology behind them. We got all the way to where we're doing till now, where we've been doing quantitative tightening for $50 billion a month for the last few months. And it's been slowly breaking the markets. The emerging markets broke first. First, Bitcoin broke this time last year, which was the most speculative element of anything, because it's basically a worthless doodad that got priced at almost $20,000. Anyway, and the whole crypto sphere has gone from $800 billion to $100 billion in change in the last 12 months. That broke, emerging markets broke, other markets broke, and then finally our market broke. And this is all a consequence of quantitative tightening, QT. So for your average reader who is hearing all these words, who is hearing all these words, what does it mean? Let me give you an analogy. The stock market is a car, and QE is gasoline, and there's no gasoline, the car won't start. So that's why in this decline, people keep looking for a bounce, and it won't bounce. I never backed off much on the way up, especially in the last couple of years, and now there's been no breathing room on the way down. My point of view during this mania that we've been in was that when it started to unfold, it would basically crash, you know, just go down and not let anybody out. And we've had kind of a slow motion crash thus far. I mean, it could accelerate and, you know, we could have a 10 or 12 or 15% down day in the market. I'm not saying that's not possible. In fact, I think it's quite possible. The Federal Reserve, is the culprit in this. And that is because they have a propensity to just print money. And each time they have bailed out when you have a bubble, you tend to have a very bad bust and people learn their lesson. But instead, in this go round, the first bubble was followed up with a bigger one. And the second bubble, which was bigger and broke and caused more damage, was followed up by an even bigger one, where the central banks around the world made interest rates basically zero, and they monetized $16 trillion worth of government debt worldwide. Now we're in the backside of this, and that's what the problem is. And the reason why it kind of accelerated after the FOMC meeting earlier this week is because a lot of people expected the Fed would say, you know, given the signals from the market and a lot of signals they would look at, people thought the Fed would back off, and they didn't. The problem is that if you just sat down and looked at a Bloomberg terminal and knew what you're looking at and said, okay, look at what's going on, what do you think we should do? You would say, well, you certainly wouldn't raise rates or tighten credit. You'd stand pat or you'd ease. Now, it's kind of a weird thing for me to say because I've been critical of the easing all along. But all the easiness created this bubble and this misallocation of capital. Now that it's biting, the Fed doesn't want to ease, and they don't want to get off their track of tightening, and they don't because they believe their own story. They think their medicine works. Powell said he believed in their models. He thought the economy was strong. So it's quite possible that the Federal Reserve could lose its credibility, like right here and now, because they won't ease when they should, and they always ease when they shouldn't. So anyway, I know that's a long, long answer to your question, but I think it's very important for people to understand all the things they thought made stocks go up. Yeah, they kind of mattered, but nothing mattered as much as worldwide QE of $16 trillion and 0% interest rates. That's why the markets went up, and that's why they're going down.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. This is a breath of fresh air for me because I think the listeners are probably tired of hearing me talk about this. I've been preaching this stuff now for 2.5 years. I felt like a crazy man yelling into a windstorm, you know. But it's great to have you back that up. And one of the biggest things that I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to convince the average mom and pop investor out there, and we've got some more sophisticated listeners, obviously, but this isn't your parents' stock market. This isn't your parents' economy.
No.
This has been hijacked.
No.
It's been hotwired. It's been hacked. And the level of danger and risk out there is really immeasurable. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes. And in fact, people should think of it this way. And when you say it's not your father or your mother's stock market, that's true. It used to be, before the central banks went wild, especially in this last go-round, that the stock market and individual stock prices were reflections of underlying companies' prospects and the economy at large. And monetary policy was a piece of the puzzle, but it was just a piece. It wasn't the only piece, although it mattered a lot, especially if the monetary policy was not being done properly. In any case, from 08 forward, the Federal Reserve tried to get the stock market to go up. They were trying to use the stock market to drag the economy along. The stock market and the economy are roughly the same size at this moment in time. And they have a fancy name for it. They call it the portfolio balance channel. So the Fed was trying to force they were trying to use the stock market to force the economy to come along. And they kind of did. I mean, the economy did come along. But now it's all going the other way, and the stock market's going to take the economy with it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Not to mention the impact it's going to have on, you know, tax receivables and all that, you know, right?
Right.
You have a economy this levered to financial assets, and then your capital, you know, you get a crash you're going to have
the deficit's going to get much bigger. There's going to be all kinds of problems come out of this.
Yeah. So, okay. One of the things I was saying a couple weeks ago was saying something about, you know, this market reminded me of the Matrix. Remember the scene in the Matrix where he says, you know, Mr. Anderson, that's the smell of inevitability. And I thought about you and your writings because I've been following you for years. And I remember sitting in my office at Wells Fargo Advisors watching CNBC, which I no longer have a TV in my office, based on advice that I heard when you threw out the CNBC, I thought, you know what? That's really good advice. So you inspired the removal of CNBC from my office. So I got to give you credit for that. And it's been infinitely better since. So it's a great prescription from a knowledgeable doctor. But I remember sitting there in my office in 2009 when they launched QE and just being very discouraged, disheartened, and dismayed because I went, you know, we're not going to learn our lesson. Here we go again. When this started, wasn't this inevitable? Wasn't this always going to be how it would end?
Most likely, because if you're going to pursue a policy like this, it's an insane policy. And so for it to not end like this, the Federal Reserve would have had to halfway through it, someone realized, wait a minute, this is crazy. We can't do this.
Right.
And what they should have done was they should never have done QE3. Maybe they could have done the first two. Maybe they would have been able to, you know, reel it back in before things got out of control. I don't know. They didn't. The problem is the Federal Reserve is the problem. They have no idea what they're doing. They don't know they foment bubbles. You know, they basically are the arsonist that lights the fire, but then they like to pretend they're the fireman that puts it out, right?
Right.
And basically, they put out the fire with gasoline, and you get a bigger bubble the next time than you had before, and they refuse to learn their lesson. As Powell said, they believe in their models, you know? And
yeah.
They really have no, I mean, and just like he doesn't understand the economy's in the process of tanking and it's going to get worse, you know, Greenspan didn't understand about the real estate bubble, and nor did Bernanke. And people think these guys are super smart and they know what they're doing. They've demonstrated that they don't. That was the purpose of my book. They've demonstrated since then that they really have no idea how the economy works and what makes it go and what impact their policies have. They just don't know the danger, how dangerous mountains of misallocated capital are.
Yeah, and for those just joining us, we're with Bill Fleckenstein of Fleckenstein Capital, and he's been kind enough to join us for the day here and share some insights with us. So when we take this now, stepping into today, looking at this market we've had, I sat with amazement. Now, one of the things we've been preaching to our clients and on the station over and over in the shows was that, hey, guys, the other thing is bonds aren't going to be the answer. A, the returns are going to be horrible, you know, in general as an asset class. And we think it's very likely that they will not act as a protective hedge. Heck, they didn't in 2008, 2009. But we've been preaching that, look, you're going to have to figure out new places to hide. The you know, the risk parity strategy that's been so popular over the last 40 years, you know, it's run its course, if not completely, pretty close. And I sat there and watched this week with my mouth wide open. And we've been looking for this, but just seeing it happen is pretty odd. The markets are down. What is this? This is like the worst week in 10 years we've had in the markets. And treasuries, the treasuries actually dropped a little bit over the course of the week. The dollar was down. How rare is that? Is that as rare as I'm seeing? I'm sitting there going, scratching my head going, man, I don't know if I remember
this.
Well,
there has been a tendency, there generally has been a tendency when stocks are weak that bonds get bid. And that's sort of the principle behind the whole risk parity stuff, that they don't both go down together. Although historically that is not necessarily always the case, always true. I think given the weakness in the stock market, it's surprising the bond market didn't get bid more. But part of the problem is, remember, it's this QT, the shrinking of the Fed's balance sheet. So they're selling $50 billion a month,
yeah.
And there maybe isn't the extra capital. So the Fed's raising rates, and the deficit's growing. And so people are maybe not so enamored of buying bonds, even for a knee-jerk move. I can't give you all the reasons. I can guess at them, but you're right. I mean, on a day like today, with the stock market getting spanked like it did, you know, for what is it, like 3% plus?
Yeah.
Well, depending on which index you look at,
NASDAQ.
3%. You would have thought the bonds would have had more of a bid, but you know, part of it is, I think that the you know, you'd have to invert the curve from the back end to some degree. Because of where the Fed's got short rates. So that may be part of it. I really don't know. That normally wouldn't really matter, but it is odd. You're correct. The fact for the dollar actually had an okay week, given the fact that the sort of the disarray. And when you look at the disarray in Washington and sort of the dysfunctionalness of the Fed and the stock market being this weak, I would have thought the dollar would have been even weaker. There's no reason why the dollar has to get a bid in a financial market meltdown. It did in 07, sorry, it did in 08, but that was for kind of special reasons.
Right.
You know, in 87, for instance, when the stock market crashed, the dollar was under huge pressure. So the dollar can be either way, depending on what the issues are driving the markets. I think the dollar is going to get a lot weaker, quite frankly, when people start looking at the size of the budget deficit and how it's going to get funded and all the problems in 19. I think the dollar will have pressure, but and the Fed's going to cave. They're not raising rates in 19.
Right.
They'll be cutting rates in 19. But that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, no, I was just having that conversation with a client. They're like, boy, so how many rate hikes do you think we're going to get in 19? And I said, none. You see what just happened. And it's another one I want to jump. Go ahead.
It's really the QT that's the problem.
Right.
Not the rate hikes, really.
Right.
But anyway, that's just to be factually clear about that.
Yeah. No.
In my opinion, anyway.
I'm in total agreement. Now, while we've got you, and just for the record, I'm assuming you probably would like to get back to your vacation. your weather there is a heck of a lot better than ours. But
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. You're a smart man. One of the things I want to talk to you about, gold, and that's near and dear to my heart. My father did a lot of VC funding and actually ran some small publicly traded junior gold miners back in the day. And I refer to myself as a gold mining brat. Spent weeks at a time and months at a time at mining operations as a kid, and spent countless amount of time underground and been around the industry my entire life. And when this all started in 07, 08, I was looking around just going, and we were in the middle of a really nice bull run there in gold at that time. But I remember sitting there going, holy smokes, it looked like the beginning of the end to me as far as, on a long-term view, the hegemonic nature of the dollar being the world reserve currency and all those kind of things. And I've been listening to you talking about gold. Where do you think gold plays? When you bring it up now, especially in the retail investment world that we live in as an RIA, I don't like gold. Nobody likes it, right? It's like toxic. It's too hot to touch. And I think Luke Groman. Do you know Luke Groman on Real Vision?
Yes, I know who he is. I don't know him personally, but I know who he is.
Right. Okay. Well, so we've had him on the show before, and he had a great saying that I loved. He said he thinks gold is going to be the credit default swap of this cycle eventually. We don't know when, and I love that quote. I know you've dug deep into gold, and you're really putting a lot of your focus there. Kind of give us the reasons for that, and if you think it has a role in a retail investor's portfolio.
Well, you have to remember that everything that's considered money is just a piece of paper.
Right.
Which means it's totally based on confidence. Everyone has confidence in the colored paper from their country or some other country. Until they don't, and then you have these currency collapses. Everyone's familiar with what's happened to the Zimbabwe dollar or the Venezuelan bolivar and all these sorts of things. So currencies are a function of confidence. It used to be that people didn't have confidence in the currency, and so they had to be back with something, i.e. gold or silver or some combination of the two. So gold has played a role as a monetary asset for, all of history, basically. And it's become less, it became less of a central focus when Nixon closed the gold window in 71. But the fact of the matter is, the U.S. dollar is not tied to anything, although we do have a lot of gold in Fort Knox. The fact of the matter is currencies are not no store of value. They get abused when the central banks just print up money to acquire assets. And so I think it's the ultimate currency. In some ways, it's an insurance policy, i.e. the example about it can protect you from the fallout of bad policies. If the bad policy creates inflation, it can protect you against that. It will tend to protect you against that. If the fallout is a weak currency, it will tend to protect you against that. If the fallout is a credit crisis, it'll protect you against that, although it may do it in a staggered kind of way. So it has that ability, but it's also has a psychological component as well, just like everyone believes that a $5 bill is worth $5, even though there's no reason it should be. It's not much different from a $20 bill.
Right.
But psychology is such that people take it on faith. Now, if they start to lose confidence in the Federal Reserve or the government or anything like that, or, they get worried about other things, then people acquire gold. So it has a place as a thing to preserve yours being an insurance policy. Now, there are moments in time, like we're about to head into, where because of all of the abuses that have gone on that haven't mattered, but will now, it has a chance to do really well. So you have moments in time where it can be a capital gains vehicle as opposed to just an insurance policy.
Right, right. And
so I think we're going to go into a period where gold can do pretty well.
And the miners, and we've been talking about this on our show, right? The miners are really levered.
So the gold miners are obviously they're in the business of pulling gold out of the ground. They used to be very expensive vis-a-vis gold because it was hard for the average person to buy gold. Now there are ETFs and various ways to buy gold. But in the big bull market that we had in the last group of years, the miners did poorly because for a lot of reasons relative to how they ran their own businesses. And they've been out of favor. So now you've got a situation where they are historically cheap versus what they might be able to earn with the gold price at today's prices or slightly higher prices. They're at discounts to book value or selling at 10 times what they might earn, much cheaper than the average stock. So this is a kind of unique moment where you can buy something that is tied to what's an insurance policy, but has a big capital gains component to it. So I think in the next year or two, perhaps even longer, gold and or gold mining stocks will do quite well. Now, but you have to be really careful with gold mining stocks. There's a lot of ways you can get yourself in trouble if you buy the wrong ones.
Oh, boy, don't I know that. I had some experience in that in the last cycle. What are some of your I want to ask you a little bit about what are some of your favorite names are, not maybe not endorsements or buy recommendations, anything like that, just generally. And then I also was speaking with an uncle of mine who ran a VC firm down in Panama, and they exclusively funded a lot of junior gold miners and raised money for them, and so he's pretty knowledgeable. But he and I were talking about the gold streamers, like a Royal Gold. So I kind of wanted to get your take on what you think of the gold streaming businesses, and then some names for us to follow that you think might be interesting as it relates to the gold play.
Well, I think I don't like the streaming business. It's a variation of the royalty business, which is a better business, but those stocks tend to be expensive for reasons I can get into, but I don't know that it really matter. I don't know that they'll give the same bang for buck that the mining stocks will, because the mining stocks have been depressed and the valuations are cheap. Whereas the streamers and royalty companies were kind of perceived to be better investments and thus didn't get depressed in price the way the miners have. So I'm not as keen on them. Gotcha. I don't think they afford the same value and the same appreciation potential that the miners do. I think with the miners, you have to try to own companies that have assets in places that are safer.
Yes.
Which means like all, North America, if possible. A lot of places in Mexico are okay. There's some parts of Mexico that aren't. Places in South America, a lot of countries are pretty safe. Some of them aren't. So you want to be in places that have the good jurisdictions where you don't have to worry about getting the mine nationalized or some radical, tax put against you. And then you want companies that are run by capable people, and that's a little harder to ferret out. But
yeah,
you don't want weak balance sheets. You better to own mines that have higher grade, that have fewer operating problems. There's a few rules that if you use them, you can cut the universe of available choices down to a rather small subset. And then you need to own kind of a basket of them because they all have different things that drive them. Some of them have the ability to grow by finding some of their explorations, the exploration they're doing. Other ones can only appreciate as the commodity price goes up and allows them to make more money. Some of them have mines in various stages of coming on and some of them have them going off. So there's a life cycle in the individual mine. So there's a whole lot of variables that come into play. And if you're if you're careful about what you pick, you have a much better chance of doing well.
Yeah. Just you gotta be able to dig into them and find that, find the value. If this gold run really comes, like with every other kind of rush, there's going to be suspect players. There's always going to be the snake oil guys that get into that game. You got to be able to ferret that out. And I also think the other thing that is really key that we pay a lot of attention to is the geology and doing your work.
Well, so you could help yourself ferret out a lot of the snake oil stuff if you tended to stick with companies that have multiple mines,
right,
or a mine up and running, because then the snake oil is when the guys are telling you about the exploration.
Right.
I mean, if you have to really know what you're doing to be involved with companies that are exploration companies. because the ability to get fooled is far higher. So if you eliminate the exploration companies, you've got a much smaller universe. You have a much better chance of doing okay and not getting, taken advantage of.
Now, a name that I wanted to get your take on, because I've had some question, a lot of questions about it, is Pretium, the Canadian miner.
Yep.
Really impressive. What was it? 6-7 years ago, they were the talk of the town. And I actually have some connections to that. My grandfather was a early funder and investor in Silver Standard, which was Bob Quartermain's first operation.
Okay.
And long relationship with them, did great in Silver Standard. I've never met Mr. Quartermain myself, but, always spoke very highly of him and very reputable guy. And Pretium's kind of fallen under, the attack. There's some questionable things, I shouldn't say questionable, potentially questionable. What is your take on that whole scenario and that whole situation with Pretium?
Well, first of all, Bob is a very capable geologist and has done very well in the exploration side of things. I know him personally. This is their ore body, Brucejack, is a it's an unusual ore body in that it is got some very high grade pockets,
right,
and some lower grade pockets. And the way to visualize it is to think of it like a loaf of raisin bread, where the raisins are the gold. There's a lot of flour in between, so to speak. And thus, how you go about drilling it before you put up your mine plan and all that stuff happens. They had two engineering firms. One of the engineering firms didn't like the way they were approaching the issue and said that they didn't think it was going to work, basically. And the stock got very controversial in the beginning. Since that time, they built the mill. They had sold a royalty stream on it. They had some debt that they took out to get to produce all this stuff. And they started producing a little over a year ago. And this year they've produced the amount of grams per ton has been a little less than they thought it would be. It's still been coming in at 12 grams a ton, which is very high. In the meantime, they got rid of the stream. They generated enough cash to buy back the stream. They refinanced the debt, so that's not even an issue. It's going to be termed out over the next few years. And they managed to expand the mill. This, because of where it is in Canada, it's an underground mine. If it was an open pit mine, it would have been much easier, and the controversy that exists would not exist. The
right.
controversy has to do with the sort of the nuggety nature of the ore body. It means it's difficult to know exactly what you're going to get, and so you have more variability quarter to quarter, and some people, are uptight about that. Part of the uptightness has been because we've still been in a bear market for these mining entities for the last few years. Gold kind of stabilized a couple of years ago and it's been going sideways to up, but the miners really haven't been able to. So the nature of the environment is people are all nervous and there were business risks coming into this year because of the stream was going to take some of the profits away, and then the debt was due this year. But the fact they got all that cleaned up and expanded the capacity by 40% of the mill means that now it's just a question of what's the ore body look like and how does it play out and what do they find from an exploration standpoint. So I happen to quite like it. I think it's very interesting, but it's not the only company that I own.
Right.
And it only has one mine. All companies with just one mine have more issues than companies with four or five mines. On the other hand, companies with four or five mines, it's much more difficult to get them to be able to grow their organic production. Right.
Right.
There's a whole compendium. There's a pendulum of risks and problems depending on the nature of the business.
Well, and that's interesting that you brought that up, because I that was kind of my take on that Brucejack mine and a lot of the critiques that it had received, because I feel like everybody thinks that mining is going to be like a widget making company, right? Like that's your grade and that's your recovery rate and boom, there it is and all that. And that's just not the way a lot of those underground mines work. As a matter of fact, my dad is my father's the CEO of a really small gold mining operation based in Lake City, Colorado, and they have a little underground mine there, and it's like a micro version of the Brucejack property, meaning you hit these pockets of extraordinarily rich ore, And then, you know, literally 10 feet the other direction, there's nothing there. As a matter of fact, I want to say they pulled 130,000 ounces out of the ground out of a 10,000 square foot area. And it was running at, and because the grades were so rich, obviously the cost per ton were microscopic, but it ran at an average of 14.5 ounces per ton. And I looked at the Brewster.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. Now, the caveat, right, is they only pulled out 130,000 ounces from a 10,000 square foot area. So they're still looking for the next, you know, pocket and hoping they find it. But, you know, nobody really knows those stories. And so they use it to kind of, you know, push down Pretium and question it. But, you know, this is not uncommon, right? I mean, these things occur and
well. Yeah, but I mean, we've been in a cycle for this industry where now people, there's almost no good news reflected in any of the securities.
Right.
It's all the glass is half empty or less, and nobody gets the benefit of the doubt on anything. We've had other periods where people will believe anything, and you know any good story people leap on. So
like Briex.
I think that. You know, that's just been the nature of, you know, the nature of how the market has been, that people have been unduly skeptical, shall we say.
And then in the course of your, this is another thing I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we've been very cautious about how we've owned gold, right? We're managing retail retirement accounts and been very cautious over the last really 7 years. I refer to it as a nuclear winter. That's what it's felt like in that space. How many times in your career, though, have the biggest gains come from those types of setups where it's you're investing in something that culturally has become almost toxic? You know, after all, it's just a relic. It's just a tradition, according to the central bankers.
Oh, yeah. Well, those periods, you know, invariably lead to really large outsized gains, assuming you're right about your whatever your particular thesis happens to be. But yes, I mean, that's where the really big gains come from, because psychology is super negative. And so, I mean, valuations are depressed. And then when the macro environment changes, or in this case, the price of gold goes up and people start to get excited and they see the reasons and they start buying it and they want to get some, then you go from valuations that are, you know, huge discounts to kind of normal to then expensive. So you get a double whammy. The valuation improves dramatically and the price of the underlying asset goes up, so the earnings go up, so and then the multiple goes up, so you get a chance to get a re-rating, and you can make a lot of money.
Okay, you know, one other thing I've got to ask you about is, and we've been, again, part of it was listening to an interview with you, but about 3.5-4 months ago on the show, we were really pounding on people needing to pull back their risk exposure, especially in tech, and being careful. In hindsight, it looks prescient, but not anywhere close to a call I heard you make about Apple. And I know you talked about this on the QTR podcast, but I just couldn't help but asking you. You shorted Apple relatively close to the highs, if not right on them. And you thought Apple was going to drop. And from my perspective, when you said that, literally my stomach clenched up, because I just went, oh, boy, you know, just, you know, it just seemed like, you know, the possibility of getting run over by a train. I was with you, you know, in theory and all that kind of stuff. What was the timing you used for that? I mean, what did you see that you thought, you know what, this is the right time for me to enter that trade? And since then, I think you said you closed it out with what, you know, a 25 or 30% move, something like that. Can you give me, though, the setup going into that where you said, okay, I am prepared to step in front of this train, and I think now's the time? What led to that call? What did you see?
Well, first of all, I thought the market had broken, because I had been looking for it. And so I thought in early October that was the start of the bear market. And thus, I thought that the backdrop was going to be make it safer. And I think I put it on initially. I was shorted and owned some puts. And I thought, well, from my short standpoint, maybe I was short it in the 220, somewhere like that. And I thought, well, if it trades back up over 230, I'll probably cover it and see what happens. I mean, sometimes you have to make tactical adjustments when you're short stocks. So I had an amount of money I was going to risk from the short, and the puts are different because I had more time to go. I thought they would have trouble with the quarter that they were reporting. And they did. And then, you know, they said they weren't going to give out units anymore, which is always a warning flag. But in addition, the thing had held up and basically, you know, more than doubled in price in the last 3 years or so, as the as their market share was declining. Their market share in the last 3 or 4 years has gone from, you know, low 20s to 13-ish. So they were losing market share. And they were having more trouble in China, which had been a big market for them. And then there was the backdrop of the China trade war. And I thought they would have trouble with the guidance. And I thought the market mood had soured. And so if that group of those things came together, if I got it right about that, I could get paid. In the past, when the market wasn't really receptive to be skeptical, so to speak, they could have said the same thing and it wouldn't have made any difference. So it was a combination of knowing the environment you're in, having a way to put on a trade and to trade around it and control your risk, and then getting the facts right that the business had been deteriorated. There was no surprise that business deteriorated. People just looked past it. I think part of it was the halo effect from the fact that Buffett has a big position, which has, you know, cost him about $20 billion or so in the last, couple of months. Yeah. Not that that matters that much to him, but I mean, to Berkshire Hathaway. But in any case, I think the fact that Buffett was in it made people feel like everything they believed about Apple was true and nothing could go wrong. And they forgot that it was just a business. It's a technology business,
right,
where change can be a big deal and saturation matters. And now the next thing's going to happen, you're going to start seeing margin pressure and things like that. So, I mean, Apple's business is not going to be in the future what it's been in the past, I don't believe.
Well, one of the tough things about it, and I got to thank you again, because after listening to your that short call, we actually pulled back our exposure. But from the retail side of it, I didn't want to be in it. But trying to find things that represented some type of sane value, we almost felt like we had a gun stuck to our head, just because, you know, the alternative wasn't Netflix. The alternative wasn't Tesla, right? I mean, trying to find things.
Right. Well, the thing of it is companies like Apple can look cheap, but that's when you look in the rearview mirror. You have to look forward and say, what are their margins going to be right, like prospectively?
Right, right.
And I think there's going to be margin pressure. And so even though it's trading right now at 11 times earnings, we might find out a year from now that actually, given what they're actually going to earn next year,
it
could be at, 15, 18 times earnings, some number like that. I don't know. And then you also have the situation when there's nobody left to buy it because everybody already owns it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this thing got to be a $1 trillion market cap.
I know.
I mean, how do you grow a $1 trillion market cap? Think about it. The numbers are so big, people have no comprehension.
Right. Well, and it was one of $2 trillion market cap companies at the time.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if you're just trying to get imagination potential, it might have been easier to have Amazon's imagination potential than Apple's. I mean, you know, but anyway,
yeah,
that's what happens in manias. Things go to stupid valuations, and instead of saying, wow, it's so huge now, how is it ever going to grow fast enough to make this work? People believe that because it got to $1 trillion, somehow that meant something great about the future. I mean, so people lose their minds in manias. That's what happens.
Man, and it's been painful. Okay, so out of respect for you, we gotta wrap this up, and I can't thank you enough, but as a parting note, if you could give some advice to a guy like me that's managing retail money and just the general investor out right now, what kind of posture, you know, what are you telling your family? What kind of posture do people need to take, and how serious is this?
Well, this is very, very serious, because this whole QE and what the Fed's done created an illusion of prosperity that wasn't there.
Yeah.
And people, nobody has dealt with the underlying that we have some massive debts in this country from a off balance sheet standpoint, whether you want to think about Social Security or Medicare or any of these things, or the unfunded retirement plans that don't have enough money in there if some of the markets don't cooperate at the city, county, and state level. So there's going to be big holes blown in these pension plans or obligations that have been promised to people they're going to be a tough time keeping them. And so when you have these manias, issues that should be addressed don't get addressed because people feel so, they're so so don't worry. There's so much in a don't worry, be happy mood.
Right.
No one deals with the problems. And then you get in the tough times, and all of a sudden now the problems are apparent. And people demand that you deal with them. And so, you know, the Seattle City Council, for instance, with all their crazy ideas, is going to have probably holes in their budget next year. Same at the state level.
Shocker.
Same in other states. And the government itself, and then the budget deficit will get quite big and people will get scared and all this kind of stuff. So I think people have to realize the last 10 years were a mirage.
Yep.
Created by central banks printing, monetizing $16 trillion worth of debt. And I've heaped criticism on the Fed, but the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are even crazier.
Yeah.
And the Swiss National Bank and the biggest central banks in the world, the PBOC, the Chinese Central Bank, wasn't as crazy, but they've done some crazy stuff too. So it's been a total sugar high, and now it's over. So what we don't know is the market going to have to actually crash further from here, probably, to get the Fed to change its policies. But that's only going to be like, okay, that's like giving another drink to the alcoholic. That's not going to fix the problem, but it might slow down the rate of descent. But this is why I was always so critical, because these policies don't work. If you can only take the drug and you can't stop taking the drug and it warps your behavior, is it a success or not? So these policies made asset prices go up. They didn't fix any of the problems. And now people made all kinds of future plans and changed what they would do. And their behavior was modified because of these policies. And it was for a reason that was false. We didn't have the prosperity. It wasn't that would look like it wasn't natural. It was induced. And thus, when it all comes crashing down, it's much worse than it would have been. So this is very serious what's taking place, and it's why I have so much venom for the Fed, because they've affected so many things in society and how businesses and governments have been run, and that they've made all of the long lingering long-tailed liability problems worse because they got larger and they got dealt with, and that'll be harder to try to address them in the next crisis. We didn't fix anything after 08. We passed Dodd-Frank, and then we made everything else worse.
Yeah, no, I remember sitting there, like I told you, I was sitting there thinking, okay, we're going to get down to business. We're going to address some of these structural issues in the economy and the government at large, and watching the reaction to that. And I grew up just a classic, you know, red-blooded American boy, believing in the promise of America. I'm not saying that's not the case now. I was just so dismayed by the lack of attack, or the you know, inability or the unwillingness of the Fed to, you know, for us to take our medicine in 08 and 09. And we just, like you said, it's like give the drunk another drink, you know, give them, you keep the, well, yep. In Seattle City Council, classic example, right? It's like the free heroin, just keep them high.
Exactly.
It's been dismaying. Well, anyway, I know you probably would rather get back to the beach than sit there and talk to us. So thank you so much for joining us, and appreciate the insights and the time you took. And great to have the hometown boy on the hometown station. And just thank you so much, and appreciate it. And I hope you and yours have a fantastic Christmas and New Year.
All right. Same to you.
All right. Thank you so much. And to everybody, thank you. That was okay. Bill Fleckenstein joining us, and he's kind enough to join us from vacation. And that concludes the interview. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.